This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Prescription drugs and Medicare, too much of a good thing? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In January, most elderly and disabled people will have at least 40 drug plans to choose from, all with different premiums, deductibles, and co-payments. That's producing so much confusion, one survey shows just 20% of those eligible plan to sign up. The $700 billion Medicare expansion may be in trouble before it even begins. On To the Point, with enrollment starting today, we'll hear about widespread paralysis over personal decisions with lifelong consequences. Will the price of drugs be affected at all? On Reporter's Notebook later on, should the United Nations take over the Internet? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Some 80% of Medicare recipients are saying no to prescription drug coverage before it even begins. On To the Point, most elderly and disabled people will have at least 40 possible programs, and their choices could have lifelong consequences. We'll hear what they're facing. On Reporter's Notebook, the Internet is international, but it's governed by a nonprofit American corporation. Should the United Nations step in? We'll hear about a summit conference in Tunisia. First, this news update. With support for the war in Iraq fading fast, the Senate today passed a resolution calling for significant transition to full Iraqi sovereignty in 2006. Jim Coonan is congressional correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspapers. Jim, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren. Glad to be with you.
Pretty loose language. The Senate voted down another proposal. Tell us about the two.
Well, one was offered by Senator Carl Levin, a Democrat from Michigan, who's the top Democrat in the Senate Armed Services Committee. And his language would have said that the president needed to provide greater information on an exit strategy from Iraq. And it asked that it establish a timetable for withdrawal of troops from Iraq. It wasn't a specific, it didn't demand specific a specific schedule, but it did say that the administration needed to provide a timetable. The Republican proposal was almost exactly the same, and that was offered by Senator John Warner of Virginia, who's the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. And he simply struck that particular line from the Democratic proposal, which was the timetable language. So as it's left, it says that that 2006 should be a period of significant transition to full Iraqi sovereignty, and it said that the administration, quote, needs to explain to Congress and the American people its strategy for the successful completion of the mission in Iraq.
Shortly after the measure was passed, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld held a news conference. Here's a part of what he said.
While the American people understandably want to know when our forces can leave Iraq, I believe they do not want them to leave until our mission is accomplished and the Iraqis are able to sustain their fledgling democracy.
Again, that was Donald Rumsfeld. Back to Jim Coonan of Knight Ridder Newspapers. Does it appear that there's some stress and tension between the Senate and the administration?
Oh, I think that's perfectly clear. I think senators are looking at polling data that suggests growing anxiety about the war. They're looking at the president's polling numbers. His approval numbers are at new lows every day, practically. And I think they're starting to chart their own course. At the same time, they don't want to be seen as demanding a specific timetable for withdrawal. That recalls the days in 1970 of the Hatfield-McGovern amendment that demanded a specific timetable for withdrawal from Vietnam. They don't want to go there yet. But nevertheless, this is one of the strongest examples of the Senate trying to exert some influence over the policy that it had not done since it had voted for that authority to go to war back in 2002.
And we should point out, of course, it's the Republican majority in the Senate that's running the show here. They voted down the Democratic proposal, but then passed one almost the same, except for the timetable and exit strategy language. Does this bill also have Senator McCain's torture provision in it?
Yes, it does. It has a couple of other interesting provisions in it. This is an overall defense policy piece of legislation. It does have a provision in there sponsored by Senator McCain to eliminate harsh treatment of detainees, in essence torture. It also contains a provision that limits the rights of detainees to appeal their cases to American federal courts. It's not as sweeping a prohibition as one that had been passed in the Senate last week. It was altered today so that it does give detainees some rights within the American judicial system, but it's still limited and significantly more restrictive than anything that that American inmates and American citizens would be entitled to under the courts.
Presuming this gets past the Senate, what about the House?
Therein lies the problem. The House contains none of these provisions. The White House would like this detainee appeals procedure to be better spelled out. It might not be as thrilled with the language that was revised today, but nevertheless it wants that. It does not want the McCain language on torture, and I would assume that it's not happy with this timetable, or at least not timetable, but at least this sense that the administration needs to explain an exit strategy better than it has. The House could very well sit on this bill. It's not a quote unquote must pass bill. There's not a demand. It doesn't contain specific appropriations of funds, so there's no hurry to get this thing done. So the House, if the Republican leadership in the House is so inclined, could very well kind of delay action on it, and we might not see it pass as law in the long run. However, that said, the mere fact that the Senate voted this and voted it with 79 Democrats and Republicans in its favor at least suggests that the Senate is flexing some muscle.
79 altogether, 55 of whom are Republicans. Jim Coonan, thanks again for being with us.
My pleasure, Warren.
Congressional correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspapers. In a moment, is the Medicare drug benefit too much of a good thing? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Anomaly back with To the Point. Until now, the 42 million elderly and disabled people on Medicare have been paying for their own prescription drugs or going without them. That burden is supposed to be relieved starting in January by the new Medicare prescription drug benefit. Today is the first day to enroll. The Bush administration says drug costs for a typical beneficiary will be cut in half, but that's only if the beneficiary signs up. Despite the government's $250 million promotional campaign, a recent survey shows that just 20% of those eligible are planning to get on board. Tricia Newman is vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation and director of the Medicare Policy Project. Ms. Newman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yours is the poll that we're talking about, and your director of polling has said there is almost paralysis over what to do. What does that mean?
Well, I think what we've seen is that seniors seem to be more aware of the Medicare drug benefit, but they're pretty surprised about the number of plans that are out there and the wide range of choices that they face. We find that only 1 in 5 say at this point they will sign up for a Medicare drug plan. So that says to us there's a lot of education that still needs to happen so people figure out whether or not they should sign up and which plan to pick.
How many choices are available?
Well, that varies from around the country. In many states, there are well over 40 different prescription drug plans to choose from, and that does not even include the what's called the Medicare Advantage plans, which are Medicare HMOs and PPOs, which provide all Medicare benefits, including prescription drugs. So some people could face, 60, 70, or even more choices for 2006.
Again, we're talking with Tricia Newman, who's vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Who are those most likely to enroll?
Well, that's a good question. There are, we don't really know the answer because we don't know who will enroll. We know some people will be automatically enrolled by the government, and those are very low-income people who now get their drug coverage paid for by Medicaid. That's about 6.5 million people. Also, people who are now in Medicare HMOs will probably make it easier for them to sign up. But the real question is, what about all the others on Medicare who are not in a program that will spill over into Medicare drug plans? And that's a large group of people who need to make a decision about whether to sign up or not.
What are the main reasons that people gave your survey for not planning to enroll?
Well, some people said they already have coverage, and that's to be expected, that they wouldn't sign up. But others said it's too complicated. I just don't know if it's going to provide help to me personally, and that's probably the biggest factor. Only 39% of people said they thought the drug benefit would help them personally. And if you don't think it's going to be of help to you, you may not be so interested in signing up. And that's why more thought needs to be given in explaining to people the kind of help they can get.
What kind of help can they get if they have to choose between 40 or 60 or 70 different programs? Who can possibly do that?
Well, it's not easy. I guess the one group of people who definitely stand to gain are those with low incomes, who could qualify for extra help from the government in paying the premiums and the cost sharing. For people with low incomes, say less than $20,000 for a couple, this extra assistance could make a huge difference in what they will pay in 2006. But to get that, they would have to apply for low-income assistance and sign up for a drug plan. Other people are just going to have to, ideally, but not always, people should be rational consumers and try to make the best of all these choices. But the problem is it's a very individualized decision, and the best plan for a husband might not be the best plan for the wife because it depends on which drugs they take. And so then it depends on their own medical conditions, maybe the coverage they already have. So it's really a very one-on-one kind of decision-making process, which makes it a little bit more challenging.
If, in fact, as few as 20%, as your survey shows, actually do sign up, what does that mean for the whole idea of insurance, where risk is supposed to be amortized over the maximum number of people?
Well, I mean, it is an issue. We released a study that looked at the effect of what could happen to premiums if sicker people sign up and healthier people do not, which is a concern. And as you might expect, premiums could rise much more rapidly than the government has projected. So that is a worry, because then healthy and sick people wouldn't be going into the pool, and premiums could rise faster than had been projected.
Have there been plans or have there been proposals for changing this? It doesn't go into effect until January.
There have been some proposals. There hasn't been serious debate, I think it's fair to say, in Washington at this point in time. There's more of an interest in moving forward, at least among the people in the administration and the leaders in Congress. But there have been proposals out there to extend the period of time, to give people more time to sign up. Some would like to eliminate the penalty for late enrollment, so it's a little bit less punitive to older people who take their time in making decisions. And then, of course, there are always more radical options that have floated around, like limit the scope of the benefit to people with low incomes, but that hasn't moved with great force.
When does late enrollment take place, or what's the deadline, I guess I should put it, for enrollment?
Well, the deadline for signing up for coverage in 2006 is May 15th. But the way the penalty works is it mostly affects people who don't have drug coverage now. If someone, say, is healthy and decides to delay enrollment and sign up in 2007 or 2008, they would pay a penalty for late enrollment because they went a few years without drug coverage under a Medicare plan, and they would pay that premium penalty for the rest of their life as long as they were in a Medicare plan. So it's a pretty serious issue, and it's a cost that adds up over time.
Tell us about one other thing that has caused a lot of confusion in this regard, and that is the so-called donut hole.
Yeah, that it's a good makes sense that that causes confusion, because it's pretty unusual in an insurance product to have a gap in coverage. What that means is, under many of these plans, the plan will help pay for prescriptions up to a certain amount. In general, that's up to $2,250 of total drug costs. And then there's a gap in the coverage, which means a senior would pay 100% of their pharmacy costs until they reach a level that would qualify them for catastrophic coverage. So it's this odd gap, which is sometimes called the donut hole, but it basically means that for people with total drug spending above a little bit more than $2,000, they will come at a point in time in the year when, rather than pay a copay or coinsurance, they'll pay the full freight.
And that then catastrophic is around $5,000 a year. So you're talking about almost $3,000 in total then that they might have to pick up themselves.
That's right.
So what's your overall prognosis about this at the Kaiser Family Foundation? You've done a survey. You've obviously done a lot of thinking about this. So what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I know this sounds like I'm trying to avoid a tough question, but I think it's too early to tell. If you know, if you had to take its temperature today, I think you'd say there's some problems, because seniors are aware but not ready to take action. But it is early. The government is continuing to push hard on education. The plans are just ramping up their marketing activities. So it's possible that all that activity will really drive seniors to pay close attention to this issue and get down to sort of the more fundamentals and make some nuts and bolts decisions about whether to sign up and which plan to pick. But a lot has to happen to reach the targets that have been set by the government.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
All right. It's a pleasure.
That was Tricia Newman, Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation. We talked to her earlier today. We've just been joined by Dr. Mark McClellan. He is Administrator of the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Very busy man on this first day of enrollment. Dr. McClellan, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Warren. It's a pleasure to be with you.
How are you going to educate 42 million people to choose from as many as at least 40 different programs, as we hear, and possibly as many as 60 or 70 different programs?
Well, it's a big task, and we're getting a lot of help. The first thing is to make sure people know the basics, which is they don't need to be an expert on all of the plan options that are out there. Medicare has close to 43 million beneficiaries nationwide who are getting their health care and want to get their health care in very different ways. So our beneficiaries only need to focus in on the options that reflect what they want. So people can start by thinking about what they want in drug coverage and go from there. And we have lots of resources available to help people make a decision. They can call 1-800-MEDICARE. That's our customer service line. It's available 24/7. People who like to go on the Internet or have adult children or caregivers who go on the Internet can get personalized help at Medicare.gov. And then we are working with literally thousands of community organizations, senior advocacy organizations, other organizations around the country to provide local face-to-face help. Many events, seminars, counseling sessions, enrollment sessions are going on right now and will be going on in the weeks ahead. And the other thing to remember is that people don't need to rush into this decision. This is the first day of enrollment, but people have 6 months to make a decision about the new program.
On the other hand, once they've made the decision, or if they've decided not to do it by May 15th, then if they want to get in, they're going to have a penalty, and it's a penalty that will last and accumulate for the rest of their lives. So there is some pressure here.
It is important for people to focus on this. It's important to focus on it because it's the most important new benefit in Medicare in the past 40 years, and also important because, like other types of health insurance, Warren, it will cost more if you wait to sign up. Many people with Medicare now, in fact, just about all of them, enroll in Medicare's so-called Part B coverage. That's coverage for physician and outpatient services. That's also a voluntary benefit and one that will cost you more if you wait to sign up for it. The Medicare Part D drug benefit is designed in very much the same way. It's just like insurance for your house. If you wait till you actually need the homeowner's insurance, it's going to cost you a lot more than if you had it ready in case you needed it. And that's why we want to make sure people can make an informed decision about this coverage over the next 6 months.
You're well aware, I'm sure, of the Kaiser Family Foundation survey, which we just talked about with Tricia Newman. What if as few as 20% of those eligibles do ultimately sign up? What might that do to premiums ultimately?
Well, first, Warren, there are a lot of surveys out there. A lot have been done recently. Some of the other ones that have come out this week showed that most of the people who do not have coverage now are planning to enroll in the Medicare drug benefit. Even the Kaiser survey, which had somewhat lower numbers about enrollment, showed many people were interested in finding out more, and when they did find out more, they were more likely to enroll. And among the people who say they're not enrolling, the main reason they give is that they've already got good drug coverage. And you know what? That's just great. In fact, the new Medicare drug benefit is going to be providing subsidies for millions of retirees around the country so that they can keep their good retiree coverage from a former employer or union in place. So all of those people who are saying, no, they're not planning on changing plans to get into a new Medicare benefit are actually, in many cases, going to be getting new help from Medicare by staying right where they are. So they'll be participating too. And that's what I mean by a program that's designed to fit with the different ways that our beneficiaries like to get their health care.
What about the donut hole, so-called, the fact that between $2,250 and about $5,100, the beneficiaries will have to pay 100%. What's the rationale for that, as you understand it?
Well, when Congress was designing this benefit, they had a certain amount of money, and they listened to the independent budget experts telling them how far that would go with the drug coverage, and it went far enough to provide very comprehensive benefits with low or no out-of-pocket payments for one out of three Medicare beneficiaries with limited means, and it also provided a basic benefit, meaning Medicare would pay 75% of the first $2,000 in drug costs after deductible, as well as protection against catastrophic expenses. I think you were just talking about that with Tricia Newman. But that's as far as the experts said the money available would go. Because people have choices in how they get their coverage, however, if you don't want a benefit with a donut hole, this coverage gap, you don't have to choose one. That's a real advantage of having competition and choice. Many of the drug plan options available everywhere in the country have no deductible because many people don't want a deductible. And a number of the drug plan options fill in the donut hole. So if you want more coverage because you have choice, because the drug plans are competing, you can get that. And that's a, go back to what I said earlier, the thing that people can focus on is what they want in their drug coverage, and we can help them get into a plan that meets those needs.
And since many people apparently are dubious about this because they already have coverage, I think it's worth getting you to repeat what you said before and make sure that we understand it, which is, as I understand you to say, you can choose the Medicare benefit and you don't lose the coverage you already have.
This is a very important point for people who already have good drug coverage, meaning coverage that is at least as good as the basic Medicare benefit that we were just talking about. Most employer coverage today that retirees have is as good or better than the basic Medicare benefit, and millions of employers are planning to take a new subsidy from Medicare starting on January 1st to keep that coverage in place. People who have good drug coverage today should be looking for a letter or information from their benefit manager, from their former employer union. They get these letters every year explaining what's going on with their coverage. This year it will tell them if coverage is good or better, and they can get a new subsidy from Medicare just for staying where they are with that new coverage, with that new subsidy.
Dr. Mark McClellan, thanks so much for being with us. We'll be right back with To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point. Just before our break, we were talking with Dr. Mark McClellan, who is administrator of the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Very busy man today because this is the first day of enrollment for the new Medicare benefit. It may cost as much as $750 billion over the next 10 years. You have until May 15th of next year to enroll. As we just heard, there is a penalty if you don't make it by that time, and it is a penalty that goes on for the rest of your life. One of the issues that has been brought up with regard hard to this plan. Ron Pollack is Vice President and Executive Director of Families USA. That's a nonpartisan consumer advocacy group for health care reform. And Ron Pollack, thank you for joining us today.
Well, delighted to join you again, Warren.
Here we heard Dr. Mark McClellan saying that one of the good things about this is that you don't lose your present insurance if you sign up for the Medicare benefit. You're nonetheless critical of the program. How come?
Well, what we're critical is that this is a very, very complex system, and it didn't have to be so. And because it's so complex, seniors across the country are absolutely bewildered about the choices they need to make. And I think a lot of people who actually could benefit from a good prescription drug benefit will not enroll in this program because they're going to throw up their hands in despair because it's so difficult to navigate all of the information among all the plans. They've got to look at the premiums, the deductibles, the copays, the size of the donut hole, what drugs are covered, what pharmacies you can go to, what are the prices of the drugs that the health plan has been able to get. And you have to do this for every one of the 40, 50 some odd plans. And so what might be good in terms of a lower premium will wind up with a higher deductible or a larger donut hole or drugs not covered. And so this is the antithesis of going to a grocery store where you get unit pricing, where you can actually compare apples to apples. Here, it's really difficult for seniors to understand what their choices are.
You mentioned prices being different. So each plan then has a different price for every given drug based on what it's been able to negotiate?
That's right. And this goes really to the question about what is the reason that we have this very complex system. The drug lobby, which really won big time with this legislation, really had one priority objective throughout the process, and that was to make sure that there was no tampering with their ability to continue increasing prices in a way that have skyrocketed in the past. And they were able to achieve it through two specific things that they got into the legislation. The first is there's a prohibition in the legislation that prevents Medicare from bargaining for cheaper prices. The second is that they were able to actually preclude Medicare from administering this benefit, and instead these private plans are administering the benefit, and the drug companies knew that these private plans would have nowhere near the market share in order to try to get a good negotiation and have leverage with the drug companies. And so as a result, three things are going to happen. One, we have a profusion of confusion among seniors, and that's what you were talking about earlier. Secondly, seniors are going to be paying much higher costs in premiums, deductibles, copays, and the donut hole. And lastly, the taxpayer is going to be socked with a bill which is extraordinary, and conservatives and liberals are going to be very unhappy with that.
Just quickly, on the question of market share, what you're saying is that if it weren't prohibited from doing it, and Medicare could use all 42 million of its recipients to bargain with the drug companies, then they'd have more clout than a given plan, one of the many that are within it, which would only have a fraction of that number.
That's right. And so the drug companies were able to get these two things. One, the prohibition against Medicare bargaining. And on the fear that that may change over time, the drug companies very much wanted to make sure this would be administered by much, much smaller private plans.
All right. Ron Pollack with Families USA. Mary Greeley is president of the Healthcare Leadership Conference. That's a coalition of healthcare industry chief executives. They've launched a national campaign called Medicare Today to help inform Medicare recipients about the drug prescription plan. Ms. Greeley, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
How do you respond to some of these criticisms we've heard? First of all, to the complexity, which both Ron Pollack and Tricia Newman talked about at great length, with 40 to 70 plans available to a given recipient, depending on the particular drugs that that person takes, husband and wife, possibly different. Isn't that an extraordinarily difficult task?
Well, fortunately, there is a lot of help out there for Medicare beneficiaries in helping them find the plan that's right for them. It's not going to be a one-size-fits-all program, and I think that's a very positive thing. There is a tool both on our website called MedicareToday.org as well as Medicare.gov called the Plan Finder. And seniors need to have some information before they go on that website. They need to know which prescriptions they're currently taking, how much they're paying for that, and what kind of coverage they currently have. With that simple information, when they put that in, it will quickly narrow down the number of plans that are best suited for them and will make their comparison a lot more simple.
What about what I heard earlier from Ron Pollack about the price of drugs and how the drug industry wanted this structure specifically to avoid having to lower the price of drugs?
Well, we are going to see lower prices of drugs. We have had a senior population that has been paying the highest prices because they have been paying full retail at their local pharmacies. Unlike all of us who have private health insurance, usually provided by our employer, we have health plans and pharmaceutical benefit management firms that have been negotiating discounts on our behalf. And for the first time, Medicare beneficiaries are going to have those plans in there competing with each other, trying to get the lowest price they possibly can. And I think they're going to be extremely effective, probably much more effective than the Secretary of HHS trying to negotiate a single price.
If the Secretary of HHS had 42 million customers behind him or her, wouldn't they have in much, much greater clout than any of the given plans with just a fraction of that number?
Well, I think we just have to look at some of the experiences we've had in other government programs like the Defense Department, where they so-called negotiated a price of $700 for a hammer. I would much rather have the private sector in there competing with each other to get the lowest price, and I think they're going to do a much more effective job.
So competition, then, is the principal word, it would seem to me, in your response to what we heard earlier from Ron Pollack.
Absolutely, and I think through competition, we're going to have more choice and really find a plan that is tailored for you as opposed to the standard plan that had been passed by Congress. That's all we had. We know we would have a donut hole for everyone. We know everyone would have a $250 deductible, and we know the premium would be $37. That was their estimate. We are now seeing plans out there in every state that will be $20 or less. So, again, I really support having that choice and competition for the Medicare beneficiaries.
Mary Greeley, again, president of the Healthcare Leadership Conference, a coalition of the industry people involved in the Medicare drug program. Ron Pollack, back to you with the Families USA. Let's take these piece by piece here. According to Ms. Greeley, negotiations over price have already begun, and seniors who've been paying full price already will be able to get the benefits of lower ones.
Well, what's really interesting, and Mary knows this, is that the past Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson, in his last press conference, he was asked, is there anything you regret during your term in office? And what he said was, what he regretted was that he was precluded by Congress and, it turns out, the White House from bargaining for cheaper prices. Clearly, at a moment when he could speak the truth, he was saying that it would have been very effective if he were given that authority. Now, we do have experience with government agencies bargaining for cheaper drug prices. The Veterans Administration does it today for veterans. We compared the prices for the top 50 drugs purchased by seniors under the Veterans Administration and under the initial temporary drug discount card program that was touted by the Bush administration. For 49 out of the 50 drugs that are the most heavily prescribed drugs for seniors, they were considerably cheaper when purchased through the Veterans Administration. So we now have good examples of how such kind of negotiation could work.
Back to Mary Greeley. What do you say to that?
Well, I think we need to look at the plan today, which is not a drug discount card. This is comprehensive prescription drug insurance. And also, the problem with comparing it to the VA, that's a very limited formulary. And, you know, it's great if your drug is on that list, but if it isn't, then you're out of luck. So, again, we think by having this many choices with this many plans, you'll be able to find the best price that's suited for the medications that you have to take. And every year, if you want, you can change plans. So you have the opportunity each year to find what's best for you.
Ms. Greeley, another question for you having to do with the donut hole. It's my understanding, again, there's that gap between $2,250 a year and catastrophic drug costs at $5,100 a year. In between there, if you happen to fall that way, you have to pay 100%. And the bill prohibits you from getting insurance to specifically cover that gap. Why is that?
Well, it prohibits getting insurance outside of the Medicare prescription drug plan. And I think what's important, now that we have seen the plans, we know that many of them will cover that so-called donut hole or that so-called gap in coverage.
So you think then that that's a straw man?
Absolutely.
Ron Pollack, what about it? What about the donut and the prohibition against insurance to cover those costs?
Well, Mary and I spend a lot of time together. I must say on that last point, that's just dead wrong. The overwhelming majority of the plans do not provide coverage in the donut hole. People are going to be on their own, and a lot of people are going to be bewildered. People who take multiple medicines, they're going to find that they could afford some protection in the beginning of the year, halfway through the year. They're going to wind up being on their own, and they're going to start skipping their medicines. One other point, Warren, and that is that the preliminary prices that we are seeing with these drug plans are even more expensive than the temporary drug discount card program. So the difference between what the Veterans Administration has been able to negotiate and what people are going to get under these drug plans is going to be enormous. One other point I guess I'd make about the Veterans Administration. The Veterans Administration does have a formulary, as do each of these plans. But we have checked with the Veterans Administration, and if your drug is not on a formulary, there's a rather simple way to get that drug even at the low prices that the Veterans Administration has negotiated. They have actually a rather flexible system that allows veterans to get the drugs that their doctors have prescribed.
So, Mary Greeley, back to you then. Why should people be reassured when Ron Pollack is able to make the kinds of criticisms that he is, particularly with regard to the Veterans Administration and the comparison to what we're already seeing, according to him, with regard to drug prices?
Well, number one, there is not unlimited choice under the VA formulary and the Veterans Program. I think we really need to look at the numbers. You know, we have 11.8 million seniors that currently have no prescription drug coverage, and they are going to see tremendous savings. They're the ones that are paying full retail out of pocket, and we know that their out of pocket cost right now on average is like $1,900, and that's going to go down to $620. That's a savings of $1,200 per year. And for those that have limited income that will be getting their premiums paid, their deductibles paid, currently they're spending $1,900 out of pocket. That will go down to a mere $130. So this is a good plan. We have a lot of work to do educating people about it and helping them make these choices as opposed to just criticizing the plan. We really don't want people to wait. If they're the ones that have no coverage now, they really are going to benefit greatly from this. And that's why we're working hard to get this information out to them.
You said there were 11.8 million with no coverage as yet, roughly 42 million in the Medicare program altogether, that those who have no coverage are paying $1,900, that for some it would go down to $620, to some for $130. How many people in those categories are we talking about of the 11.8 million? Do you know how to break that down?
Let's see. The 11.8 million, I'm going to take a rough guess here. I believe probably about 5 million are those that will be receiving a special subsidy because of their limited income.
So, Ron Pollack, isn't it at least better for those people?
I think for low-income people, they certainly should enroll. Low-income people will get a benefit that is going to be helpful. They won't have a choice. The poorest of the poor, actually, are not going to be better off because they today get coverage through Medicaid, and Medicaid's drug formularies are much more flexible than the formularies of these private drug plans.
Will they go away? Will they be replaced by the private drug plans?
Yeah. What will happen is these lowest income, the poorest of the poor, about 7 million people, they will have a choice to enroll. If they don't enroll, they will be automatically enrolled by the federal government in one of the private plans. The catch is that when they get automatically enrolled in a private plan, they won't necessarily be enrolled in a private plan that includes their drugs on the formulary. And so it's critically important that the poorest of the poor are carefully mindful of, if they get automatically enrolled, that they're in the right plan.
Ms. Greeley, what happens if people who are relatively healthy do not in large numbers sign up for this and consequently reduce the risk pool and leave only the very sickest people in there? What happens then to premiums? Are you concerned about that?
Well, that's exactly the reason why we're giving a six-month period in which to enroll. And then after that, there is going to be a penalty, as you pointed out earlier. The idea there is we really want people to get into this program. We don't want them to wait longer than 6 months. And we want to make sure those that don't have high prescription drug usage now understand that as we age, usually we do need more prescription drugs for diabetes, high cholesterol. We want to get them in now, make sure they have that insurance. And as you said, it will give us a healthier risk pool as we begin this program.
All right. Mary Greeley, president of the Healthcare Leadership Conference. Your websites, MedicareToday.org and Medicare.gov. Is that correct?
That's correct.
MedicareToday.org, Medicare.gov. Ron Pollack with Families USA. Do you have a website, or is there any way that you can help people who are trying to wrestle with this?
Yes. Go to familiesusa.org. And we have a great deal of materials about the new Medicare plan.
All right, familiesusa.org. And, of course, the earlier number we were given by Dr. Mark McClellan of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is 1-800-MEDICARE. He says that's available 24/7. Thank you both for joining us. Thanks to our other guests as well. We'll wait and see, of course, what happens to the Medicare drug provision. The Internet was essentially invented by the U.S. military, along with American educational institutions, and domain names, Internet addresses, and the like are controlled by an American nonprofit called the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. But the Internet's worldwide in scope, and other countries say they want a role in how it operates. Some even threaten to set up Internets of their own. More in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. An international summit gets underway this week in Tunisia with the original goal of spreading the benefits of communications technology to the developing world. But the subject that is grabbing the headlines is control of the Internet. Porter Bibb is managing partner at Media Tech Capital Partners. That's a private merchant bank specializing in new media and technology. He's also author of It Ain't As Easy As It Looks, Ted Turner's amazing story. Porter Bibb, good to have you back with us.
Good to be here, Warren.
What about UN control of the Internet? Since it's international, does that make sense?
In principle, it does, unless you look at what the United Nations does with anything that it takes control over. This summit meeting is a good example. It is so overladen with agendas and vested interests that probably nothing other than the headlines that you cited a moment ago are going to come out of it.
Well, why are there some countries who are unhappy with their – I guess I should put the question another way. Doesn't it make sense that a lot of countries that don't like the United States are unhappy that such an important unit of communications or entity of communications is flourishing in their countries and some company in California is running it?
Well, it makes a lot of sense, of course, but the real issue on a country-by-country basis is not who owns or controls the Internet, but what's being said by the citizens within any given country. And there's a tremendous amount of repression, particularly in the home site of this conference in Tunisia, where in the last week, several bloggers have been jailed for very long periods of time, 3-, 4-, 5-year sentences for running afoul of censorship problems on the Internet.
On the other hand, those countries which want to exert control over their populations also don't want to have subversive material and information being broadcast. Do they have a right then to try to stop it?
Good question. They're one of the major agenda items here at this Tunisia conference is governance on the Internet. And It's unlikely that local control and censorship is going to be taken away. If you look at a country, for example, like China, the government there has over 150,000 people employed full-time just censoring everything that goes out across their country on the Internet.
And they're able to do that. The technology exists that they can stop a blogger, for example, in Beijing or some obscure place you'd never heard of before.
Yeah, I think the sheer force of numbers and the massive effort that they have to police the Internet is enough to keep most people fairly conservative in what they're going to put on the net.
And there's nothing, then, that the corporation that's in charge of Internet domains and names can do about that.
Not much. And I don't think that there's the mandate that the naming rights has, that has to be controlled by somebody, and eventually that may very well be elevated up to United Nations status. But that's really not the issue. Control of the Internet is, first of all, there's physical control. Who has the fiber optics that are the backbone of the Internet? And there are about a dozen large telecommunications companies that control that aspect of the net. Then there's controlling the information, the data that goes on the net. And that's, I think, going to be a country-by-country situation for the foreseeable future.
Some countries, as I understand it, incidentally, we're talking with Porter Bibb, who's managing partner at Media Tech Capital Partners. Some countries have suggested that they might want to set up their own internets. What would be the impact if many countries did that?
Well, it's inevitable. There are going to be different networks. They're going to be interconnected, but we already are in the advanced stages of a fragmented Internet. When you have different delivery systems and different channels, Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and all of the different delivery mechanisms that have been devised in the United States are now spreading out around the world, and they're creating basically separate but interconnectable networks. And it's probably inevitable that some countries are going to want to put up a proprietary internet, but it won't get very far if it doesn't connect with the global internet.
Because obviously that's one of the features of the internet,
that's
that it is global.
One of the great attractions, sure.
And who is attracted to it the most at this point? What's at stake financially with the internet?
Well, right now, let's start with Google and say that they have tapped a global advertising bonanza. Their profits in the last quarter were nearly $200 million on advertising revenue. That's probably the greatest pot of gold that the Internet offers, because it is free and or relatively free if you can get on the Internet, and in many countries it is totally free. And the huge volume of traffic over the last 10 years that the Internet has created is a bonanza for advertisers, and that's going to be the sustenance for a long time. Then it breaks down into selling everything from books and collectibles to information and data. Not to mention music and movies.
Will the United States, do you think, we had indicated at the outset, and we haven't talked about the history of the Internet, but it had to do in large part with the military and the various big universities around the United States. Given what's at stake here, will the United States ever allow somebody else to control the Internet, even though it says at the moment, as a government, it doesn't control it, it's this nonprofit organization?
Again, you need to parse control. What exactly are we controlling? We're controlling names and URLs and to a certain extent the sites that exist on the Internet. But there's no reason that other people couldn't end run that control. It's basically the censorship aspect, I think, that is probably the defining control factor, more than sites and names.
What are the prospects that the Congress might decide that it doesn't much like all of the things that are going out on the Internet and that there ought to be some control here in this country?
Well, we have not only millions and millions of blogs, but this is the first war in history that's being blogged and reported on from the trenches in Iraq. There are thousands of servicemen right now who have set up blogs, and the Pentagon doesn't like that, and I'm sure a lot in Congress don't like it, but there's not a lot you can do about it.
So is there then any real threat to the Internet at this point from this meeting in Tunisia? You said at the outset that probably all we'll get out of it are a lot of headlines.
I don't think that anything tangible is going to come from this. The best that is likely to come from this Tunisia conference is a restatement of governance, that it's a free service, it's free of government controls, censorship notwithstanding, and that violators and corruptors are going to be punished on a global basis. But those are the kinds of truisms that typically come out of a UN summit.
Always good to hear from you.
I'm sorry to be so cynical, but I have to give you, Warren, the bottom line. A human rights activist in Syria, despite the fact that there's rampant censorship in that country, said, frankly, the Internet's the only way for intellectuals in our country to share ideas today, and I think that's going to be the status for a long, long time in the future, thanks to the Internet.
Porter Bibb, telling it like it is, managing partner at MediaTek Capital Partners. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Ileana Justice and Christian Bordahl. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.